Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was a travesty, crude, privileged white boy lacrosse players at Duke raping a black woman for kicks. And then it was a different travesty. Innocent young men railroaded by a politically ambitious prosecutor and a public too willing to believe. Race and class stereotypes turned on their heads and unleashed with a vengeance. A media machine and academic critics ready to send innocents to prison for years. That case is not closed. Up next on Point, a scathing new account of the lessons of the Duke no rape story. We'll hear from the author, from the faculty, and from the coach sent packing. We will hear in this hour from a local newspaper editor and a high-profile Duke University professor who were in the middle of the fray, and we will hear from the Duke lacrosse coach who was forced to resign, sent packing before the charges were dropped. But first today, joining us from Washington is Stuart Taylor, columnist for the National Journal. For 8 years, he covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times. He's a Harvard law grad. His hard-hitting new book, co-authored with Casey Johnson, is Until Proven Innocent, Political Correctness and the Shameful Injustices of the Duke Lacrosse Rape Case. Stuart Taylor, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me, Tom.
Boy, you take a lot of people over the coals here. Let's start with the source of your outrage now when you look at this case. What is it?
Well, I'd like to think that the book is more factual than it is outrage. The outrage, I think, emerges from the facts. We don't try to beat people over the head with our opinions until we've related facts that we think justify them.
Plenty of facts here, but a fury riding underneath them, and I'm just curious about how you would describe that piece.
Well, we think the lessons of first, we think it's an inherently riveting human drama, but the lessons, we think, which is what you seem to be asking about, are, I think, the prosecutorial misconduct in this case was very extreme and was a vivid illustration of how innocent people can be victimized by prosecutors and their accomplices. And this prosecutor, Mike Nifong, had accomplices. This raises a question of national importance as to whether we need reforms not only in Durham but elsewhere to prevent this sort of rogue prosecutor. The media, I think, was guilty of really outrageous politically correct sensationalism in this case, ignoring facts and evidence in order to tell a storyline about privileged white people oppressing a black woman that a lot of people in the media just love the storyline so much that they couldn't bear to look at the facts. The extremist faculty at Duke, dozens of them, formed into a mob to attack the lacrosse players even after the evidence of their innocence was prolific on the public record. And the Duke administration, President Richard Broadhead and Chairman Bob Steele and others, were enablers, I think, of all of these abuses, and in particular the firing of Mike Pressler, the coach, by Broadhead. Mike Pressler, I'm proud to say, I've become a friend of, I hope, and his wife in the course of this. And,
the former Duke lacrosse coach. We'll speak with him, yes?
Yes, and that the firing of Mike was outrageous. In fact, Jim Coleman, who you also have on, did an investigation with the faculty committee in which I believe he found that Mike Pressler did nothing wrong, and this was a committee appointed by the man who had fired him on the day he appointed the committee.
Stuart Taylor, we're going to hear from some of these big participants in this whole drama, some of whom you praise and some of whom you pillory. I should say, for full disclosure, I have a son who went to Duke, not during this period. It's caused me to kind of lean back and wonder what was going on in all of this, but I hope not more than that. I wish you'd take us to sort of the heart of your indictment, in effect, against each of these three or four parties to this that you just named. First, Mike Nifong and the prosecution. Take us to, I don't know, is there an event or a particular act or a cluster of events that form the heart of your criticism of Mike Nifong? Get particular for us.
There are months of events, so I'll begin at the beginning. Of course, Mike Nifong has now been disbarred, spent a night in jail, and faces criminal investigation, perhaps, so I don't know he has any defenders. But to give an idea how it started, at a time when he was losing an election campaign, this came along as manna from heaven to give him an opportunity to win. On March 27th of 2006, which as far as we know is the first day he had any involvement in the case, he first met with two police officers who had been investigating it. And the picture they painted of the evidence was so weak in terms of the prosecution that Nifong said, "We're," and then he used an Anglo-Saxon monosyllable, indicating that at best this is a terribly weak case and we're going to have trouble winning it. He went directly from there to begin a week-long series of media appearances in which he, in very forceful and inflammatory terms, said it was certain that there had been a rape, that the lacrosse players had done it, that anybody who didn't come forward and point a finger at someone else was an accomplice, that it was accompanied by racial epithets, that it was racial motives, and with great confidence. And this would have been outrageous and clearly unethical, even if it had been true, because prosecutors aren't supposed to attack prospective defendants in that fashion publicly. There are rules about that. But, of course, it was all false, as we know now, and he was lying. Even if he believed these charges the first day, which is doubtful after that meeting with the police, he had evidence in his hands very soon after that, within a day or two or three, that almost conclusively established that this alleged rape had not occurred. He charged right ahead full speed, and the reason he charged right ahead full speed, we think, is that his only way of winning that election was to throw gasoline on the flame on the fires of racial discord to get enough of the black vote to support him. And once
in a district that was 40% black, and him facing re-election,
right. And once he had done that, he if he'd backed off as the evidence of innocence piled up, he would have the people he'd inflamed would have turned on him, and he would surely have lost the election. But he won.
Turn to the media, if you would, Stuart. The heart of your sort of indictment of the media or allegation against it.
From the very beginning, almost all of the papers, both local and national networks, credulously took almost everything that Mike Nifong said as true. Now, I give them a little bit of a pass for the first two or three days because it's unusual, as I've just said, for a prosecutor to rant and rave like that. And it's natural to think, well, he must have the evidence. He'd be a nut not to. But the evidence of innocence began pouring out most dramatically, and there are many installments, but most dramatically on April 10th of 2006 when the DNA evidence was made public, showing that there had been no match between any lacrosse player's DNA and anything found on or in the accuser. Now, the Nifong's office itself had said that if that was the result of the DNA test, it would prove that they were innocent. But he just charged ahead and disregarded that, and the media, by and large, treated it as a bump in the road, explained it away. The New York Times was especially outrageous.
What's your explanation for why, in your view, the media charged ahead when they should have seen warning signs all over?
I think there are at least two forces working in sync. One was plain old-fashioned sensationalism, which is a weakness the media has had from the beginning of time. It sells newspapers and so forth. The other is the politically correct aspect. I think that a large number of the people who covered this case and a large number of people in the national media were grinding axes in terms of biases that they had. And ideological views that they had about the oppression of poor black women by rich white men and so forth. And they could not bear to let go of that ideological morality play long enough to look at the facts which proved that it was false, at least in this case.
And then on the political correctness front, you turn rather fiercely to the Duke faculty. And what's the heart of your indictment, complaint, criticism there?
The faculty, much like the media, jumped on this immediately and proclaimed the lacrosse players guilty or implied that they were guilty, presumed guilt. And in very angry and inflammatory terms, dozens of extremist faculty members, I'll call them, personally denounced the lacrosse players and also signed a statement, 88 of them, that was published in the school paper that strongly implied they were rapists and that also said flat out that that white students at Duke, by and large, were racist, which was a ridiculous and false thing. I emphasize that the people that we're talking about here, we don't call them liberal. We don't think they're liberal. We think they're such extreme leftists that they almost come around the backside where the extreme rightists inhabit. And there are numerous examples detailed in the book of the kinds of things they said. And the kinds of things they said, I think most people who read them will agree, were hateful as well as being false.
We're going to begin to hear in just a minute from some really front row principals in this case, a journalist in Durham, North Carolina, James Coleman, a professor at the law school there, and from Mike Pressler, the former coach of the Duke lacrosse team, who was forced to resign in the midst of all this. Let's take a call first from Iowa City, Iowa, and Bob. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love your show. I was wondering, is there any recourse legally for these players as far as against the media goes? I'm not necessarily talking about a lawsuit, but I'm thinking of people like Nancy Grace, who are on TV every night just demonizing these players, and anyone on their show who would care to defend them in any way were ridiculed, mocked, and then the day that their innocence is proclaimed, she takes the night off. It's some way for them to make people stop doing that, or once their innocence has been shown, make them, you know, take it back, anything. It just, my heart goes out to these guys.
And you say, you know, make them pay, them in this case, the media, somehow. I mean, yeah. There's this $30 million legal demand on the town of Durham by the players. But what about the media? Bob, let us pick that up. And Stuart Taylor, I'll come to you with it. But let's listen first to just one example of what Bob in Iowa City is talking about. Here is the CNN talk show host, Nancy Grace. She covered the Duke lacrosse case very aggressively, has come under criticism for rushing to conclusions. Here she is in one show with Duke University student Stephen Miller. He headed a campus conservative group.
Stephen Miller, what's your response to the indictments handed down and the arrests?
Well, I think I speak for many students when I say that we're very, very concerned that two innocent people may have possibly had their lives ruined.
Lord!
You're saying it's not possible they're innocent. That's not even in the realm of possibility.
It's not possible, but a grand jury has heard evidence and deemed this fit to go to a trial.
Right, and we're saying that...
without ever hearing what the victim has to say, you're saying the grand jury is wrong.
I'm not saying I'm convinced at all.
The victim is lying, and your first problem is two innocent people.
I didn't say that. I said we're concerned that it's possible that two innocent people may have had their lives ruined, because this case does have many irregularities and many inconsistencies.
Do you have a sister?
Do you have a sister? Do you have a sister? He's saying two people there. Of course, there was a third indictment charge that came down. But you can hear exactly where Nancy Grace is going. And Stuart Taylor, a Bob in Iowa, says, is there recourse for the players on the media front?
I think that some of the players might have a libel suit against Nancy Grace if they chose to bring it. I have no idea whether they'll bring it. Now, what we just heard was not the worst thing she said in terms of falsehood. It was outrageous, I think. Some other things she said were flat out false. The difficulty in bringing the libel suit, other than, you know, it's always difficult to bring a libel suit, is that usually she didn't name names. Now, in this case, she implicitly named the names of two of the defendants, and so they might be able to sue her over this. But usually when she's just smearing the entire lacrosse team, that runs into what's called the group libel doctrine as a matter of law, which is if it's a group of more than 25 people, as it was here, they can't sue for libel as a group. It's sort of too diffuse. But that's not an absolute rule, and I think if lacrosse players wanted to sue Nancy Grace or wanted to sue Wendy Murphy, who is often on her program and who spewed forth falsehoods at like almost a dozen a day. A little hyperbole there. I won't take that literally.
Mm-hmm.
But various others, including, I think, the Durham Herald-Sun.
Let's hear from the Durham Herald-Sun. Editor Bob Ashley joins us from Durham, North Carolina. He wrote a lot of editorials about the Duke lacrosse case. Comes under some pretty intense scrutiny in Stuart Taylor's book for supposed bias. Grew up in North Carolina. Graduated himself from Duke University in 1970. Bob Ashley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Tom, and hello.
We're kind of in the lion's den here. You know, Stu Taylor and Casey Johnson have come after many, including you. They called your newspaper's coverage of this case deeply dishonest. Talk about one-sided articles and grossly misleading pro-Nifong editorials. What do you think of their post-game analysis, Bob?
Well, I think it's easy to look back from a distance, many months removed from the what was going on at the time, and take shots. You know, certainly we've been criticized for our coverage of this, and newspapers are often criticized for their coverage. So it's, you know, I respect what they did, and I'm looking forward to reading their book. I've only read the reviews of it so far, but I'm looking forward to it, and many people here in town are reading it with great interest.
Looking back, do you think you got caught up in stereotypes? Duke is a bastion of privilege. I mean, it just is, and it is kind of a white bastion of privilege. Durham is a divided town. You've got a poor black part of town, and there's a lot of history here. Do you think, looking back, that you were a prisoner of stereotypes that overrode your caution about a presumption of innocence?
Well, that's entirely possible, but I think one of the things that we tried to do, both in our coverage and in some other discussions I had with other media folk at the time, was to try to back people off from those stereotypes. I think the early caricature of Duke as a bastion of privilege was hyperbolic and overdrawn. I think the caricature of Durham as a racially divided city, while it is certainly a racially mixed city with a history of some racial tensions, was not particularly awash in incipient racial strife when this was going on, and we were trying to damp down some of those stereotypes. Were we, in the cool light of history, perhaps too trusting that the judicial system was working as it should? Yeah, I'd say so, but so were lots of other folks.
Stuart Taylor, here's the editor himself of the Herald Sun in Durham. Is this a sufficiently, I don't know, self-searching look back in its tone for you by your lights?
You know, the proof is in the facts, and the facts are recited in the book. And if I might just briefly quote two things from the Durham Herald Sun.
Mm-hmm.
March 28th, here's what they said in an editorial. Quote, when police officers arrived at, this is March 28th of 06, when police officers arrived at the house with a search warrant on March 16th, none of the players would cooperate with the investigation. False, 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 outrageously false. They all cooperated fully. Mm. Later, under threat of, I'm still quoting, later under threat of further penalty, 46 members of the team were DNA tested by police. Well, none of them opposed being DNA tested, this idea that under threat of a penalty, the allegations of rape bring these students' arrogant frat boy culture to a whole new sickening level. Well, that sounds like stereotyping to me. Quote, we agree that the alleged crime isn't the only outrage. It's also outrageous that not a single person who was in the house felt compelled to step forward and tell the truth about what happened. End quote. Presumption of guilt.
Mm.
Here's a briefer passage that I think would give Colin Finnerty a very strong libel suit against the Durham Herald Sun.
That is one of the three indicted, yes?
Yes. This is on October 17th of 06. The Herald Sun editorial kept writing that Colin had been convicted of an assault, quote, with strong homophobic overtones against a gay man on a Washington, D.C. street, end quote. It had been absolutely clear in the public record for months before then that nobody that the man was not gay who was supposedly assaulted, and that although Colin was convicted of assault on a weird theory, it was undisputed that he never hit anyone. He was knocked down. He never landed a punch and never tried to.
Bob Ashley, do you fear a libel suit?
That's probably the sort of thing that's best for me not to comment on one way or the other, quite frankly.
Let me just ask you this then. What's the big takeaway in your mind from this whole saga? What's the lesson that you draw as an editor right there on the front line?
The lesson that I draw, well, it's certainly the lesson that many folks have drawn and that we would draw is that, you know, you can never be too skeptical. And I think we were skeptical in many instances, but perhaps not sufficiently skeptical again in hindsight. Some of the editorial comments that Stuart cites, certainly looked at from the vantage point of 18 months later, probably have proven to be mistaken. But they were based on the best available evidence and judgment at the time, and journalism is, as everyone famously quotes, the rough first draft of history, and we don't have the luxury of waiting several months before we wade into the fray.
A very rough first draft. In this case, Bob Ashley, editor of the Herald Sun in Durham, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to welcome another voice from Durham, North Carolina. James Coleman is with us. He's a law professor at Duke University. He headed a faculty committee that reviewed the Duke case. He's a former legal advisor to the Federal Department of Education, has held key positions within the American Bar Association. James Coleman, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
So Stuart Taylor holds you up for praise in a book where many are pilloried. Says you did the right thing, came in and brought some equanimity to the school's review of this case and the lacrosse players within it. But let me ask you, he goes very hard after the Duke faculty for being prisoners of political correctness. You're part of that faculty. What do you make of that assessment?
Right. Well, first let me say that I think, you know, Stuart and KC have done a great job in setting out the facts of the miscarriage of justice that occurred here. I think where I part company with them is when they try to take some facts and make broad generalizations about the faculty at Duke, and particularly labeling them as extremists and suggesting that political correctness here at the university played a role in what happened to these students. I reject both of those conclusions.
We'll ask Stuart about that, but let me ask you more broadly, if I may, as a professor, as someone who knows North Carolina well, as an African-American man, you know the history here. Do you think the country, the media, were prisoners of a, I guess what at one time would have been called an admirable sympathy? Here was a black woman claiming she had been raped by young white men. I mean, this goes to an old American story. Do you find it, you know, outrageous, despicable, wrong, that many Americans were very prepared to listen to give credence to that case?
Well, I think this is exactly the problem, not only in this case, but in the criminal justice system generally, which is that we often are reacting to stereotypes. Mm. You know, Stuart mentioned the stereotypes that black men suffer under. And I think that this is another case where, you know, different stereotype, but basically people making judgments in a criminal case about based on stereotypes. I think this was a criminal case, and if it had been focused on as a criminal case, a lot of the collateral damage that was done could have been avoided.
Mm, there's a straight-up kind of legal response here. It's a criminal case, and let's focus on it in those terms, not necessarily just in the terms of history. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Stuart Taylor, interesting here. You praise James Coleman for his kind of cool hand in the midst of all this, and yet he now rejects your characterization of the Duke faculty as prisoners of political correctness. What do you think of that?
Well, that's correct, and Jim and I have discussed this in other fora. I have the greatest admiration and respect for him. He acted heroically in this case. I'd be glad to detail how he acted heroically.
Give us just a sense of it.
And I, when President Broadhead fired Mike Pressler, the coach, he appointed a faculty committee of chaired by James Coleman with six or seven other professors on it, I think. To investigate the culture of the lacrosse team and the coach. And presumably he expected a report that would validate his firing of the coach and would validate his trashing, President Broadhead's trashing of the team. Well, the report that Jim produced in his committee less than a month later, I think, was a total vindication of the coach and almost and a great vindication of the team. He did criticize the team for drinking too much, being too loud, mm-hmm. noisy parties, rowdiness. But on all other fronts, serious character evidence, I think, was very favorable. That was a stunning departure from the almost universal mindset at the time, which may be why the media almost entirely ignored Jim's report when it came down.
So you admire his assessment there, but why don't you admire his assessment of the Duke faculty more broadly around this issue of political correctness?
I respect his assessment of the Duke faculty. I respectfully disagree. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, his criticism on that. I respectfully disagree with it. I'm happy to let people who read the book judge which of us is closer to the truth. If you'd like me to read another short passage that gives a little flavor of what I'm talking about,
yes, please.
I'd be glad to do so. Mm-hmm. And I'm not picking on the worst of the worst are people named Houston Baker and Grant Farrad, who were in such demand that Baker's been hired away by Vanderbilt and Farid's been hired away by Cornell, which may go to our broader generalizations about colleges. But here is William Chafe, one of the most prominent and prestigious historians on the Duke faculty, one of the former dean of the college, prestige for his scholarly work on the civil rights movement. He associated in an op-ed on March 31 in the Chronicle, the student newspaper, he associated lacrosse players with, quote, white slave masters who were the initial perpetrators of sexual assault on black women, end quote, and white men who portrayed black women as especially erotic, more driven to sexual pleasure and expressiveness than white women, end quote. Chafe fantastically suggested that the whites who lynched Emmett Till, a 14-year-old black boy viciously beaten, shot, and drowned after he allegedly whistled at a white woman in Mississippi in 1955, Chafe suggested that that case provided an appropriate historical context through which to view the actions of the lacrosse players. And, of course, it's revealing that this great historian got the date of the Emmett Till murder, of the Emmett Till lynching, wrong, but that's the least of his sins.
In a moment, we'll hear from the former Duke lacrosse coach, Mike Pressler. He's got his own book out, but let's listen back for just a second to North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper in April of this year dismissing the charges against all three Duke lacrosse players implicated on rape charges.
We believe that these cases were the result of a tragic rush to accuse and a failure to verify serious allegations. Based on the significant inconsistencies between the evidence and the various accounts given by the accusing witness, we believe these three individuals are innocent of these charges.
North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper. Let's take a call from Harriet in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Harriet. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I may have a rather unpopular point of view.
Let's hear it.
I grew up in Georgia. I'm working on a PhD right now in ethnomusicology, and I just want to point out something kind of curious. We have a huge hue and cry. Granted, justice should be done, but how many black men, like the Emmett case, how many black men have been accused, been imprisoned, been given the death sentence, who never had recourse?
Who didn't have that big team of lawyers that these three.
Nor the media for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of years. And how many women have experienced rape that went completely unjustice, you know, no justice for that.
Right. May we separate those, Harriet? Because Stuart Taylor, in fairness, speaks to your first one. But on the second one, how should that weigh in here? Let's say there were many women, let's say there were black women, raped over many years around the country in the South. Okay, here's a particular case. How should that history come into play in how this case is approached, or should it?
Well, that's a very good question. But the thing that I think is interesting is we speak a great deal about the privilege of higher education and an institution like Duke. But it's ironic that we have the tables, as it were, turned. You know, the three white men falsely accused for someone's political,
gain, perhaps.
Aggrandizement or whatever.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it's not appropriate. It's completely screwed up. And, the media is the media. I mean, I don't approve of that at all. And yet, this woman, the CNN lady, Nancy, whatever her name
Nancy
is.
Nancy Grace, yes.
You know, what she's coming out of, if you look at it historically, it's not appropriate because she has huge influence from the media standpoint, but I think she's simply reacting in the human being way, which is all the unfiled and unhandled cases.
Harriet, let us pick those up if we may, and they're wonderful points. I appreciate them. Stuart Taylor, first to Harriet's point, I should say, in fairness, you do address this in the book. You make much of prosecutorial abuse and make it very plain that the overwhelming majority of it in this country does end up on the heads of minority Americans.
Yes, we do, and I think it's appropriate to draw a lot of attention to that. And I think one of the tragedies of this case, actually, is that here was an opportunity to have a cross-racial, kind of cross-ideological coalition to recognize the risks of out-of-control law enforcement and to work for reforms. Here was a case where a lot of more conservative whites could identify with the defendants in ways they might not always when it's a poor black defendant. And there was the opportunity for, say, the NAACP, which has always been a champion of poor black defendants, to get together with them and say, we don't think the white people ought to be mobbed either. Instead, the NAACP and other black leaders, many of them, joined the mob. The other point I would make is, although we have a shameful history of abusing the rights of black people, and we have a terrible history of rape, of course, I think the worm has turned to the point that we detail a number of cases in which black athletes were accused of raping white women that disappeared without a trace. Charges weren't brought. Headlines weren't made. I think that in today's day and age, at least in the academic and journalistic worlds, people are far more likely to rush to judgment against someone, a white a person accused of victimizing a black person than to do the reverse.
Professor Coleman, James Coleman, and we're going to turn to coach, former Duke coach Mike Pressler in just a moment, but I have to ask you, to Harriet's question, you know, you're the legal scholar, you had a front row seat here. Does the awareness of history have any place in how we approach allegations like these? She says, look at history. This was a human reaction. Does that have a place in this arena?
Well, let me respond both to that and also to what the point that Stuart just made. I mean, both Stuart and your caller talk as if we're talking about competing interests here, that somehow either it's justice for the three Duke students or it's justice for African Americans, but that those two things are somehow competing. I don't think that's the case. I mean, obviously, we have the historical discrimination as well as the ongoing discrimination against black people, but I don't think that has anything to do with whether these three Duke students should have been treated fairly. That is a separate issue, and I agree with Stuart that I think that it's in all of our interests to have protected these students from the miscarriage of justice. I disagree, though, that somehow they are special. And I think that's one of the objections that I have, is trying to make their case special.
Special in what regard?
Well, special because it happened to them, special because they were white, special because the accuser was black. I mean, you know, that's what's happening here, and it prevents exactly the kind of coalition that Stuart said he thought was possible from this case. Mm.
Professor Coleman, Stuart Taylor, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Smithfield, Rhode Island, Mike Pressler, former Duke lacrosse coach. He was forced to resign in this scandal. He coached at Duke for 16 years. 2006, he was named National Coach of the Year. He maintained a 100% graduation rate for his players. He's co-author of It's Not About the Truth, The Untold Story of the Duke Lacrosse Rape Case and the Lives It Shattered. He's now a coach at Bryant University, the lacrosse team there in Rhode Island. Mike Pressler, Coach Pressler, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
There's a lot we want to hear from you, but let me just ask you first, with everything that's gone by here, do you miss Duke or not?
Well, I think there's a lot of people that I certainly miss. We had some great friends down there in 16 years. Some of my other colleagues, other coaches, I certainly miss those players that are still there and the ones that graduated. So, you know, that's what I miss the most, the many great friends and a lot of those players.
What's your sense, when you look back on this now, Mike Pressler, what do you think gave the kind of green light to trash these players and throw your career for such a giant loop here? What was it that gave a green light to that?
Well, I think there's so many layers to this this case, this story. I mean, so many factors. You just can't say there's one key element. I mean, that's what made this case so unique and such a national situation, and all the media coverage was all the different layers that were involved, all the different elements and factors, and that just came to a head in the spring of 06.
Did you ever feel or fear something like this might happen? I mean, you know, you've got this majestic Duke campus. You know the town it sits in, and the racial lines there, and the kind of shotgun shacks not very far apart from those beautiful Duke facilities. You knew you had an all-white team. I mean, the law enforcement put it up on the poster, all these white faces looking out, and you knew that these weren't angels. I mean, these were college guys who were carousing and rowdy and drinking. Did you ever feel you were sitting on a powder keg like this?
Absolutely not. And also, we did have one terrific young man who was African American in our team. So, we weren't.
It's funny he didn't make the poster.
Well, that was because he didn't fit the description of from the accuser. So that's why he wasn't involved. But he was definitely a very valuable member in our team and a terrific young man. But I just take offense that, you know, when people look back at our tenure there and those kids in particular, that like many others, they paint those kids with the same broad brush and say, hey, these guys were different than the other students socially, that they had an unbelievable record of misbehavior. I take great offense to that. I think that has been very much overplayed. It is not true to a lot of to such a degree, and you can't have kids that excel in the classroom like they did, excel on the field, and quote, using a Mike Nifong phrase, act like hooligans, every weekend. That certainly wasn't the case with those kids.
If you could go back, and of course I'm sure the first thing you would wish is that these false, apparently, allegations were never made in the first place. But if you could go further back than that, is there anything you'd change about the way you interacted with your team, about the way you might have guided them, spoken to them, influenced their perspective on the world, or do you consider that question itself kind of part and parcel of the bad allegations?
I don't try to relive the past there. I mean, the last 18 months, we've learned a lot. All of us, Professor Coleman, Stuart Taylor, all of us that have been involved in this have learned so much. And to kind of relive the past and say, we coulda, shoulda, woulda. No, I mean, there's nothing I look back on those days and said I should have done differently. You try your best as a coach to, do the right thing, not only by the players, but certainly your university, and guide them and discipline them when they need disciplining, but encourage them and support them and be there for them. So,
do you think those students, those players, had any idea what a powder keg they were sitting on top of? I mean, they were out in the neighborhood, they were drinking, they called for the stripper. Do you think they had any sense of the fire they were playing with here?
I would say absolutely not. I mean,
they have had?
You got to remember now, we're dealing with men that are 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. I mean, people like Professor Coleman and Stuart Taylor and myself, we're grown men. I think we certainly have a much better handle on situations and where to go and what to avoid. That's part of, do I condone that behavior? Absolutely not. I mean, that was a gravest of mistakes they made, but understand this, is that, that goes on every weekend on every college campus in this country. It's not a phenomenon that's unique to Duke, and that's a battle that the administrators at these universities, the coaches, the professors deal with on a weekly basis. So it's a part of the culture that we continue to try to educate and improve. But it's been an ongoing phenomenon for before me, and it will continue to go on after me.
There's a lot of sympathy now for these three players who were charged and then proclaimed innocent. What about the woman who was there that night, Crystal Gayle Magnum? Looking back, how do you feel about her? Do you feel sorry for her at all, or
I do. I really do. She was a poor soul. I mean, she's a victim in this case, and what Mike Nifong and the police and how they handled her and how they misguided her, I believe. And I have no ill will towards her. She's a victim in this case, I believe too. And I think, again, the powers to be, the prosecutor, the police, they were the professionals here. They were the ones to see through this for its untruth, from day one, and chose not to. and made in Crystal Mangum, certainly, as I mentioned, a poor soul in this affair.
Mike Pressler, former Duke lacrosse coach, now at Bryant University in Rhode Island, coaching lacrosse. Coach Pressler, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let me take a call from Laura in Boston. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been following this story for a while. My concern about all of this is not just the racial undertones. Put that aside, I feel like this is a class issue because of the outpouring of lack of objectivity from people across the board.
What does that mean, class issue, that what people wanted to go after young men perceived as privileged?
Absolutely. Here were bright young men, full of themselves, on a athletic team. They didn't even stop to think. They just judged immediately.
They, as in the media, the public, the critics.
The media, the public, the critics, the New York Times. I was so disappointed with the New York Times.
Laura, our time is short, but let me put that to you, Stuart Taylor. Do you make a hierarchy here of what was at work, race, class? Does it matter which?
They were all mixed together, but certainly what Laura says is true. There was a lot of class hatred of these people, and it was based on a stereotype. Yes, it's true that lacrosse players on average probably come from fairly fortunate families in terms of wealth. One-third of these players were not privileged by any stretch. Four of them were sons of retired New York firefighters. And quite a few others were also sons of people with what might be called blue-collar jobs. Mm. There are a lot of people who just wanted to hate them because they're privileged, supposedly. And there are a lot of people who have something against athletes. I think that's a very important part of the mix. And I think the New York Times, and in particular sports columnist named Selena Roberts, just spewed hatred at them with a class bias on their sleeve.
Plenty of tensions in our country. James Coleman, do you find Duke changed in the aftermath of this saga or not?
Well, I mean, it certainly has changed because, we were under the microscope for 18 months. I think the real question is, what's going to come of this? I mean, is it going to bring us together or are we going to, are we going to take up armed camps and, fighting each other?
What's your early guess on that?
Well, I hope that we come together. I mean, I hope that that we learn from this and we learn that the things that affect black people affect white people, too, in the criminal justice system.
We'll take that as one big takeaway. James Coleman at Duke University Law School, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
And Stuart Taylor, co-author with Casey Johnson of Until Proven Innocent. Stuart Taylor, thanks for your work and thank you for being here.
Thanks very much for having me and for such a good cast of other commenters.
It's great to have everyone. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.